Support comes from St. Louis Public Library Foundation, helping the library serve children and their families with programs and services needed to become lifelong readers. More information about the foundation is at slpl.org.
This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. About a two-hour drive south of St. Louis is the city of Sikeston, just north of Missouri's Boot Heel. Sikeston is known for its historic downtown, for Lambert's Cafe, home of the Throwed Rolls, and the annual Sikeston J.C. Boot Heel Rodeo. But there is a part of Sikeston's history you won't find on the city's website, and it's the subject of a new documentary film and podcast by Kara Anthony. Kara is a Midwest correspondent for the nonprofit newsroom KFF Health News, and she joins us now to talk about her Silence in Sikeston documentary work. Kara, welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Now, before we get started here, I do want to note that the conversation we'll be having will involve descriptions of violence and specifically racial violence that may be disturbing or not suitable for some listeners. Kara, in the introduction, I mentioned Sikeston's history, and your film starts right with that. And it's the story of Cleo Wright, a black man who was lynched by a mob of white Sikeston residents after he was arrested for allegedly stabbing a white woman named Dillard Sturgeon in her home. Kara, help by sort of setting the scene for us. What was Sikeston, Missouri like in 1942?
It was a racially segregated community, Elaine. I mean, you had black people literally living on one side of the track known as the Sunset Edition, and you had white people on the other. Black people were there working in the fields, sharecropping, while white people were going about their daily lives and enjoying other opportunities. And unfortunately, even today, we still see racial segregation in the community. But in 1942, segregated community.
And there was a great deal of wealth there, wasn't there?
Oh, yeah. I mean, cotton was king back then. It still is king now. And people were making money. There were multimillionaires in Sikeston because cotton was a cash crop and they were raking it in.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's something about most millionaires per capita in America?
Yeah, in the country. It was amazing. Back then, you could imagine people, you know, having these well-kept homes. But again, on the other side of the tracks, people were living in shacks, shanties, and black residents weren't enjoying the fruits of their labor because cotton was also a weaponized crop. Let's just say that. And, again, we still see the remnants of that today.
Right. And in 1942, I mean, there's the backdrop of World War II, and lynchings were not uncommon then, right?
No, lynchings weren't uncommon. Oftentimes, though, when we think about lynching, we think about the Deep South, but lynchings happened everywhere. Racial violence was happening in America everywhere, not just in the Deep South. And in 1942, Cleo Wright was lynched. His case was happening, as you mentioned, during World War II while Americans were fighting overseas. You know, people started to also wake up here and say, look, we need our freedom here at home. And that's when you see something called the Double V campaign emerge. The NAACP gets involved. A lot of black newspapers also start to join in this campaign and vocalize how wrong lynching was and is in America.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the many people that we meet in the film is Carlene Harrington and her younger brother, Harry. Now, Carlene was a child when Cleo was killed. Again, that's 1942. But Carlene, she witnessed Cleo's death. And in the film, we see her and Harry sit down and recount how they remembered Cleo's lynching and the aftermath.
We were just kids outdoors playing and talking. Uh-huh. Had a big police car come down the street, hollering and saying, all the better get off the street.
Because
he had a man's leg tied to the back of the car, dragging him. And so they had drug him from downtown across the railroad track. I said, Daddy, we better get out of town. been setting the sunset on fire, and police and things were everywhere. I just wanted to leave. And my daddy kept saying, when I go, I know place, and we're going to be deaf here. So our house that night was just full. People sitting up making coffee and just don't know what to do.
And they told me they picked up rocks and bricks and crowbars and just anything to protect our community.
Daddy got shotguns and everything else. It was a horrible time, and a lot of people left town, and they left their properties and everything. Had this suitcase on back of the cars. I was crying, everything else.
And again, that was Carlene Harrington, who was a witness as a child to the lynching of Cleo Wright. And in the film, Carol, we see Carlene, like she's touching her face as she is sharing this recollection. That is an indication of some lasting effect. What effect did the killing of Cleo Wright have, particularly on Black citizens of Sykeston?
It really impacted the way that they moved throughout the town, throughout the city, the way they raised their children, the way they saw life and their point of view. You know, we talk about in the podcast version of this that silence has been used as a tool of systemic oppression for a very long time. So it's like they witnessed this brutal lynching, but they weren't allowed to talk about it. They had to carry on with life. And so the mental health effects of that were evident, the strain. But we also get into physical health effects that can come from holding something like that in silence, not being able to talk about the racial violence that they witnessed really impacted people's bodies as well.
Is that something that folks talked with you about?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you have people that were maybe they hadn't made those hard connections immediately, but I talked to plenty of people in Sykeston who were dealing with high blood pressure or had issues with diabetes, obesity, etc. And you would think that we would make those connections and say, okay, this is weighing on me, but oftentimes people don't, Elaine. It's like the physical and the mental get separated, but they are deeply connected, which is something that we also explore in the podcast.
Mm-hmm. And you talked about silence as a weapon. What kinds of harms does silence wreak?
It's one thing to be a victim of racial violence, to hear about it, to see it. It's another thing not to be able to talk about it. And so that can really not only, again, weigh on your mental health, but weigh on your physical health. And then you pass that down to the next generation. And so it can have all sorts of effects. And sometimes people don't even realize the weight and what they're carrying. But again, studies have shown time and time again that this is serious stuff, and we really need to look at it because you can deal with anxiety, depression, you can even become suicidal, which is really serious stuff.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a scene in the film where viewers meet someone who is directly connected to Cleo Wright, and that's Nanetta Forrest. She's the daughter of Cleo Wright, and it is an interview with Nanetta at her home in Elkhart, Indiana, and it's 79 years after her father's killing. Now, Nanetta was not born yet at the time of her father's lynching. Her mother, Ardella Gay, was pregnant with Nanetta then. Now, in the following clip, Nanetta shares her ponderings about what could have been had her father not been killed by that mob in Sykeston.
I do wish I had got a chance to get to know him, because I often wonder what type of person would I be today had he been in my life. Would I have been the same person? Would I have been a different person? And this is something I'll never know. Every now and then, people still bring it up about Cleo Wright getting lynched down south. Had it been done differently, went to court, had a trial or whatever, but it didn't happen that way. You did anything that didn't go along with what they wanted you to go along with, they could lynch you.
And again, that's Nanetta Forrest, who's the daughter of Cleo Wright. Nanetta talks there about people bringing this up over and over again. What kinds of effects does that have on a person's well-being all around, Kara?
I mean, look, people brought it up, but they didn't bring it up, too. Nanetta, I just want to point out there, and people will learn this in the film and the podcast as well, she learned that her father was lynched while she was watching a game show with her grandfather. Mm-hmm. There was an old game show back then, and it was called Strike It Rich, where people could go on television and try to win money for disadvantaged families or disadvantaged people, sometimes veterans, you name it. And so her grandfather says to her, you know what, Nanetta, you could go on the show. And she's like, you know, granddad, why would I be able to go on that show? And she's like, oh, people could win money for you because your father was lynched. And then he pulls out this newspaper clipping that tells the story of Cleo Wright. And by the way, it's really important, too, I think, for us to also mention in this, is that Cleo Wright's story, his lynching, was America's first federally investigated lynching. The first time the FBI investigated lynching as a federal crime, they came to Sikeston, Missouri. They didn't go to the Deep South. And so, again, like, it's important for us to talk about these things and to have these conversations because they have been silenced for so long. I mean, she didn't even know that her father was lynched.
Right. What a thing to learn in that way. So history, it has often occurred to me that when we talk about America's history of racial violence, it's framed like it's something that is ages ago. It's in the past. But you are able to speak with several people who either witnessed Cleo Wright's lynching firsthand or folks whose lives were directly impacted by the loss of Cleo's life in a very particular way through white mob violence more than 80 years ago. How do you think people need to understand history in order to understand that it has effects that continue long after some date in time?
Yeah, there was a wonderful quote that's a part of this series where we talk about, I think we're going to dive a little bit into this in our conversation today, Elaine, but to dismantle racism, you have to know the history of racism. And so oftentimes people want to look the other way, to ignore it. But in this, we're really pushing back against that. And that quote is from a professor. Her name is Keisha Bentley Edwards. She's a professor at Duke University. I just want to give a shout out to her for that. It's like when she said that, I got it. It crystallized for me. It's like we have to know this history in order to dismantle racism. Now, as a journalist, it's my job to tell the story, but also as a Black American, I deeply understand why we should be having these conversations.
We need to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll discuss what there is to learn from revisiting the history of racial violence, like the 1942 lynching of Cleo Wright. And we'll also talk about what's considered a modern-day lynching in Sikeston, the fatal 2020 police shooting of Denzel Taylor. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back. Let's return to our conversation with KFF Health News Midwest correspondent Kara Anthony. We're discussing her work on Silence in Sykeston, a documentary film and podcast that explores the lasting health consequences of racial violence, specifically a lynching in 1942 and a fatal police shooting in 2020 in the city of Sykeston, Missouri. And again, we want to remind you that this conversation will involve some descriptions of violence, specifically racial violence. So if this content is going to be disturbing to some or maybe not suitable for some listeners, we ask you to move with kindness and discretion. Now, before the break, Kara, you were talking about silence. And silence is, maybe you can think of it as an effect. It's also a choice for certain people. And in your documentary, you introduce us to Michael Jensen. And Jensen is the former publisher of the Sykeston Standard Democrat, a newspaper in Sykeston, Missouri. He posits that perhaps we shouldn't rehash these moments in history.
I think there remains a level of communal shame, communal regret, and I can't justify it. But let's let a sleeping dog lie. I mean, come on. What is served by talking about this, okay? Will it change our community? Will it improve race relations in our community? It's legitimate to say, are you really trying to grind down to zero, or are you just picking a scab?
So, Kara, Michael Jensen asks a few questions there and poses sort of this rhetorical question about whether we should talk about that history. So will it change the Sykeston community to talk about the lynching in 1942 and then police killing of Denzel Taylor in 2020?
Yeah, I think there's already starting to be some forward motion in Sykeston. Just a few years ago, we documented and captured the remembrance ceremony for Cleo Wright, where you literally had people from the community come in and finally, for the first time, publicly acknowledge his life and not just what happened to him, but who he was as a father, who he was in the community, but also saying, yes, a white mob came in, pulled him out of a jail, set him on fire in front of a church on a Sunday morning. Mm-hmm. And that acknowledgement was healing for a lot of people. Yeah. And so my answer to Mike and to others that might say, what is served by talking all of this about all of this? Well, the answer is healing. Mm-hmm. And people need to heal in order to feel like they have a sense of community that they can live and thrive and be happy in.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to rewind a little bit because we didn't actually talk about the 2020 police killing of Denzel Taylor. Now, shortly after in the documentary, there's this discussion of the ripple effects of Cleo Wright's killing. We get to the 23-year-old Denzel Taylor and the police killing that took his life. Denzel was originally from Chicago, but he moved to Sykeston some years before he was killed. What is it that brought Denzel to Sykeston in the first place, Kara? And did either his mother, Jean Kelly, or his father, Milton Taylor, have any inkling about what had happened with Cleo Wright in 1942?
No. I mean, Cleo's story was, first of all, it was largely buried by the community. And so I don't believe that they knew the details of it. People whispered about it before we came along and started knocking on doors. But Denzel moved there for a fresh start in life. You know, his mom said that he was having some issues in Chicago, and she thought of Sykeston as a small town, you know, quaint community where he could possibly find a job and connect with his father who lives there. And that was the plan. It was like, this is where you're going to be able to restart and get going. And unfortunately, his life ended before it really even started.
Mm-hmm. And what was it that led to Denzel's being shot?
Well, he had been in an altercation with his father, and so they were arguing, and he shot his father. So in this documentary and podcast, we're also challenging and asking the question, who deserves justice? But Denzel had an altercation with his father. His stepmother called the police for help. He later returned to the home, and he was unarmed when he returned, but unfortunately, the police did not know that, and they opened fire on him and shot him, unfortunately, at least 18 times that we know of that he was shot, and he died on the scene.
Mm-hmm. That part of the documentary was something that I was not expecting. And part of telling Denzel's story and his killing includes the body cam footage from Sikeston Police Public Safety Department's response to his father Milton's 911 call, his stepmother, should say. Their brief interaction with Denzel between Denzel and police, and then that shooting. It's graphic. You see blood. You hear moans of pain. You see how many bullets had been shot, and then you actually witnessed Denzel's body falling. Why did you decide to include that in this documentary?
I think oftentimes it's easy to skip it or look the other way, or even because it's hard to look at, but in this, we wanted to really challenge people and say that it's absolutely necessary for us to look at, for us to, and we did do some editing around that. I just want to make that clear. And we had a lot of conversations around it, but to really examine this as a public health issue, I thought it was absolutely necessary for people to see and include so that we don't become too jaded. I encourage people to take care and to maybe pause or skip if that's what you need to do. But I never want people to, especially as a journalist, to dilute a story, to dilute a situation. We have to understand that this is ugly, that it's brutal, that police killings are violent. And that's why we decided to include that.
Mm-hmm. Were there any discussions about not putting it in? Like, did you have to make a case for it, Kara?
Yeah. I mean, you don't see the number of times that he is riddled with bullets. So we decided to make a cut there because it is hard to look at out of respect for the family. You know, as a journalist, it's very important for me to consider that, and that even his thinking about what his daughters will see mm-hmm. down the line. You know, his oldest daughter, when I interviewed her and did so with her mother's permission, she was under the impression that her father was sleeping and that he had not been killed by the police. She had no idea. Now, she was just 4 years old at that time. She's older now. But I thought about all of those pieces. But this is our truth. This is still where we are in America, Elaine. We still have a very long way to go. Black men and women, people of color, are still getting gunned down in America, and we need to look at it. It's a public health problem. People should not be losing their lives in this way, and it's a conversation worth having.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of family, Kara, I want us all to hear now a brief montage of Denzel's family members sharing what they want or wish they had after Denzel was killed by police. This is a montage with his mom, Jean Kelly, his dad, Milton Taylor, and his fiance and the mother of his children, Michaela Jackson.
I obtained a lawyer, and I just say it's a moral standard for me to seek justice. I hope that the police officers, the chief of police, I hope they have a wake-up call. And I want them to be cognizant of what they are to do when they put on their uniforms and they get their weapons and they're out to protect people. and not to kill people.
I was angry. I was very angry at Denzel. I was angry until I saw that video. When I saw that video, my anger just went away, and I began to cry. And they took away my chance to make amends with my son. They were supposed to come there and defuse the situation, and they made it worse.
Denzel needs justice. Just like any other person that has been put in Denzel's situation.
That was Denzel's fiancée, Michaela Jackson, his father, Milton Taylor, and his mother, Jean Kelly. Kara, all of Denzel's family members mentioned policing and justice. And we learn through the documentary that none of the officers involved were charged with a crime. What is it that connects policing and justice to a community's health?
Yeah, I mean, look, communal mourning is very real. Communal grief is real. You know, as a health journalist, as a public health journalist, we're tasked with looking at the wellness of a community. And so, yes, I do look at police violence cases, community violence, gun violence cases, particularly oftentimes out of my hometown of East St. Louis, Illinois. But when a bullet is fired in, shots are fired in a community, it's not just affecting that family. You have an entire community that is feeling the health effects of that. We talk about in the podcast something called anticipatory stress, which means that people are often, moms and dads, parents, guardians are often waiting for the other shoe to drop. People feel nervous. It's like, could that happen to me? Could that happen to my child? Could that happen to my grandchild? And so we see this in communities across the country. We use Sykeston as an example, but that's a very real issue. And so that's why it's important for us to look at these as a public health issue and a community issue, because a community feels the effects of each case every time.
Mm-hmm. There are so many parallels between Denzel Taylor's and Cleo Wright's stories. Both were Black men who were killed before they could face formal charges. And then there's the criticisms of policing, the families and communities hurting. And both Cleo and Denzel had daughters who never had the chance to meet them. Was the juxtaposition of these two stories in your mind necessary to getting at what is in the title of your documentary, to getting at the silence?
Yeah, I mean, I received a lot of questions, even some criticism from people in Sykeston that thought, oh, why would you tell these two stories side by side, parallel? But it came from one of our producers for KFF Health News. His name is Zach Dyer. He wrote a beautiful line that says that, you know, these were two Black men who were dealing with public health threats of their time. For Denzel Taylor, that was police violence and his police shootings and killings. And then for Cleo Wright, it's lynching. And so I think it's very important for us to understand that Black men in this country, Black women in this country are still, facing those issues, and that it was important for us to look at lynching and police killings because they are both deeply connected. What Cleo Wright's daughter felt, we can imagine, is what Denzel Taylor's daughters will feel. You know, what Denzel Taylor's family felt, we could imagine, is also what Cleo Wright's family still feels today. I mean, we are talking about two families who are deeply still in mourning and trying to unravel what happened to their loved ones.
Something that you have written about is your own sort of family history and connections to racial violence. Can you share a little bit about that and why your personal history is something that is relevant to this larger story?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's one thing to examine other people's stories. You know, as journalists, that's what we're tasked to do. But really in this process, Elaine, I realized that I did not know my own story, that I have spent the larger part of 15 years of my journalism career extracting stories from a community. But it was my father who actually sat me down and told me the story of my Uncle Lehman, who was shot and killed by the police in the 1940s. Now, again, like Cleo and Denzel, my Uncle Lehman had been accused of a crime, that he was driving a wagon and mule team that crashed in the back of someone's yard and ended up, a white woman, we believe, called the police. He got into an altercation with the police, but unfortunately, he was shot and killed during that altercation. And it really made me think about, again, who deserves justice, because all of these issues that we're talking about, Cleo Wright assaulting a white woman, allegedly assaulting a white woman, Denzel Taylor shooting his father who lived, my uncle who was driving a wagon and mule team accident and got into an accident and then had an altercation with the police officers, would that have warranted the death penalty? Mm-hmm. None of those men are alive anymore. And so it was really important for me to look at that, to understand it. As I'm asking this of our community, of communities in Southeast Missouri and the Midwest and beyond, I needed to examine my own story and to get into the healing that our family needed to do. Because that's really what I want people to walk away with this, is that healing is possible, it's necessary, but we have to break the silence mm-hmm. to heal.
And this last question here, I want to bring up again what Michael Jensen, who was a publisher, former publisher of the Sikeston Standard Democrat, that newspaper in Sikeston, what he said about picking a scab. If there's a scab, that means that there has recently been bleeding. What does this documentary as a film and as a podcast do to get past the scab point and not be picking and actually get us to a point of healing?
Yeah, we are giving people an opportunity, an outlet, and hopefully a template to have a conversation, to say that it is okay to talk about these things. It's okay to say that, yes, this happened to me, that happened to my family. And hopefully that lets the system know, the powers that be, the old guard know, is that the people aren't just going to take things lying down. You know, I think Mike also says it's like, let a sleeping dog lie. Well, my argument in this whole thing is like, the dog is still very much so awake, and it is roaring, and that it never went to sleep. And these conversations are absolutely necessary, because we have to think about the next generation and the world that we want them to live in.
Kara Anthony is a Midwest correspondent for the nonprofit KFF Health News and the person behind the documentary film and podcast series Silence in Sikeston. Kara, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
This episode was produced by Maya Norfleet.
Our audio engineer is Aaron Dorr. This podcast was mixed and edited by Aaron.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.